Hello and welcome to the very first episode of the Cider Voice podcast, except we're not doing interviews with cider makers. We've got a roundtable discussion with some of the finest voices in cider. So I'm going to introduce them one by one for your listening pleasure. My name, if you don't know me, is Albert Johnson. I'm one of the directors of Ross & Wye Cider & Perry Company and the main person behind Cider Voice Calls, the audio section of cidervoice.com. I'll introduce my co-founder of Cider Voice, the main contributing author, Ben Thompson. Ben, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. Really looking forward to trying the cider that we have for everybody and having a little chat.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ben. I'll introduce the voice of Malt Review and his soon to be announced new publication, as well as the co-editor of Graftwood, Adam Wells.
Hi there. Thanks very much for having me on Cider Voice.
We're very privileged to have you, Adam. And last but not least, the host of Fine Cider Friday, going back years now, future cider maker, James Finch, a.k.a. The Cider Critic.
Ning. Glad to be here. Excited to try this cider.
Great. So this is our first episode, so forgive us if we have some stumbling blocks to get over, but we're looking forward to having an excellent and exciting discussion about cider, that thing that all of us talking and all of you listening share as your one true passion in life. So, Adam, can I please call on you to introduce the cider that all four of us are going to be drinking tonight?
Yeah, certainly. So this evening we are going to be drinking a cider from Smith Hain in Devon. We're going to be drinking their Special Reserve 2018. So Smith Hain are a very small cidery run by William and Anne Chambers, who are lovely. They're in North Devon, I believe, and they've been making cider since 2014, starting on an old straw press and growing out from there, making cider from the eponymous Smith Hain orchard. So they make a range of ciders. This is the one that's most obvious if people are buying it online by the fact that it has a large red spot on the label, as opposed to their Method Traditionnel that has a yellow spot, or their standard vintage, which has a green spot. So this is, I think, William's favourite cider of the ones that he makes currently. And it is a blend of 5/6 peeved cider with a 1/6 dry cider, which is made from a general orchard blend of several varieties, including Yarlington, Dabinet and Tremlett's Bitter, and several others, which I can't remember. So that's what we've got here.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Adam. And shall we say cheers? All of us have opened our bottle, and we will dive right in.
Cheers.
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 Aroma is marvellous, isn't it?
Yeah. You definitely get that like bittersweet character, don't you? I think there's a really sizable amount of bittersweet in this, including like Tremlett's and Yarlington Mill and Dabinet, but that it's very Dabinet-y with that Christmas spice, like cinnamon, nutmeg, clove on the nose for me.
I must admit, I foolishly left mine in the fridge too long and only just took it out right before we started this. So mine's slightly too closed at the moment, but obviously I've had the cider a couple of times before now. And I remember what kind of stood out to me is that often when you get keeved ciders, you get all of that juiciness, but you don't necessarily seem to get the kind of definition and character from the apples. Whereas with this, I just remember drinking it for the first time and thinking the structure was really, really wonderful. And even though there is some sweetness there, it doesn't at all feel kind of too flabby, I suppose. It still feels like it's kind of got that structure and that tannin and grip.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, particularly about it not being too flabby and not being too kind of like, yeah, all over the place. It's got a real, like you say, structure and journey across the palate, hasn't it? And the tannin is really lovely, actually. I've not had a lot of keeved ciders, but I don't remember there being quite so much pronounced tannin in a keeved cider like this before. But it's really nice. It keeps it really drinkable, and it's not, like you say, it's not like catching.
I believe actually there's also a very small amount of a tremlet blend that he does in this, which obviously I believe tremlets is a Devon variety. You might put me right on that one, Albert, but that's got that wonderful structure, and I think a small amount of that possibly has gone a long way to adding that grip.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, and I think Ben was absolutely correct when he pointed out in the aroma that you can really pick up on the bittersweets. It's amazing actually, because there are so many different varieties in this blend, but I think if you go looking, you can see and extract the individual characteristics of some of those apples in the aroma, and in particular tremulous bitter really comes across. If you have a single variety tremulous bitter in one glass and move your nose from that one to this glass, you'll be able to see just that small imprint of Devon character that it gives. And so I think it's a tremendous achievement actually to make cider with so many different varieties but still maintain the character of all of them and have them in harmony with each other.
Yeah, it's 5/6 keeved, isn't it? And that blend is like 40% Yarley and 40% Dabernet. And I think my first reaction was similar to Ben's, that you've got that kind of bitter orange spice that you really get with Dabernet, and then that kind of woody note that Yarlington is really known for. And what Albert's saying there, the way it can encapsulate so many different apples and let them all kind of shine through in their little elements, but actually as a harmony as well. I could actually just sit and sniff this all day.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's what really struck me when I had it, is that you have some keeves that are wonderful. They're ripe and they're sort of soft and mouth filling. But this one, it sort of really felt like it had that structure and that definition. And as you say, you can just pick those varieties out. What one thing that's interested me, I reviewed this on Malt in November, I think it was. And I noticed that a common characteristic between this and the traditional method was that I picked up what I kind of described as an almost kind of metallic tang towards the finish. And it's something that I had thought I'd kind of picked up on some tremulous bitters in the past. But when I spoke to William about it, he said that interestingly, somebody who had looked after the orchard before him had commented that ciders from that orchard had historically been recorded having what this chap called an iron cut. Which I thought was a lovely way of describing it. But I wonder whether that was something, that was to do with the tremulets or to do with the orchard itself. I just don't know, but I thought it was an interesting thing to add.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fascinating. I wonder what the geology is like underneath it. So doesn't have an effect, doesn't it, the terroir? Sorry.
What I was going to say, we didn't cover, which we planned to. If one of the cider makers in the call could explain to us what keeving is. Or add a... Basically, anybody but me.
Someone volunteer. I mean, obviously, Ross and Y, we don't keeve. We tried it once, and it was a big disaster. I know that the basic idea with keeving is the objective is to get a naturally sweet cider where you've retained natural apple sugars, which in a normal fermentation, they would all be used up entirely. Whereas in keeving, you, through the introduction, you can attempt to do it naturally, which is what William said that actually he prefers to do, or the more reliable way, the way that it's done in Normandy, is using a keeving kit with some kind of salt, I think, and calcium carbonate. They might be the same thing. And what you do is you collect the nutrient up in a pectin gel, which forms on the top of your cider barrel, your fermenting barrel. It's called a chapeau brun or brown hat, and you can rack that off. You take the cider out from underneath it and leave that mass of nutrient behind, which leaves you with a low nutrient cider that basically the yeast will run out of fuel to feed themselves with. So there may be sugar left, but they don't have any fuel to keep themselves going to consume all that sugar. And you get a naturally sweet cider that way.
Nice. Well, I think that was pretty well described, actually, Albert.
Yeah.
The key, right, is the lack of nutrients, isn't it? That's like the key of what makes keeve different to cold racking or anything like that, is you're depriving the yeast of the nutrients, and then it doesn't have the like you say, the drive to be able to continue the fermentation. And then you can bottle it, which I think is interesting to point out at this point that this cider is 4.5%, isn't it? So a lot of like naturally fully fermented ciders will sit at 6%, 7%, 8%. This is 4.5% because there's all of that residual apple sugar left in there. And you taste that on the, particularly in the mouthfeel, don't you? It's got like quite a full mouthfeel because it's a higher gravity liquid, essentially, isn't it?
I think it's particularly kind of interesting to point that out, Ben, because, you know, 4.5 is a very, very low, especially considering the varieties that are in there, but also the vintage. In 2018, a lot of the fully fermented ciders, Albert, I remember you saying, were particularly high that year with all their sugars. So you see the degree of the drop off from keeving this rather than. But I think what really strikes me is that even though you get that sort of character of the keeved ciders and the kind of flavors of the bittersweets, as we've said, is that it really doesn't feel at all like it's lacking in any sort of structural component, and it doesn't feel that the sweetness has overwhelmed the cider to any degree. You know, the sweetness is there. If you had it something that was fully fermented, you obviously notice it even more, but I'm not drinking this and just thinking sweet as occasionally I do in a Kiev that perhaps doesn't have either the tannin or the acidity.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Adam, that all the best Kiev ciders I've ever had have been really well balanced and well integrated. You know, sometimes you have a Kiev cider and it is just like drinking apple juice, basically, and it's like real like sugary sweet apple bomb. But the best ones are always nicely kind of like integrated. And like one that I really love is like Pilton's Tam O'Shanter. I think that's got that, again, that kind of structure. It is a little bit like fatter than this is, but that's probably because that one is a full Keith cider rather than this being only 5/6, isn't it?
What I find interesting about this one is and I've had a lot of Keith ciders that are made over here. It reminds me very much of France. And the French obviously do keeping very well. They've done it for hundreds of years. And what you find with their ciders is that, you know, it's very clean. There is a lot more structure to it, like we're describing. But then over here, where, you know, the skill is not, the art hasn't been perfected so much, quite often you find a Kiev cider where there's the yeast has been stressed a little too much. And you occasionally get these kind of off flavours, maybe the odd bit of a sulfurous-y note. Mm-hmm. That takes a while to kind of dissipate. This doesn't have any of that. This is just, you know, full of fruit, juicy structure. Yeah, it's really enjoyable.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because this was another thing that William was speaking about, and he said, you know, that is a problem, and it echoed things that I've heard from, plenty of people who've done any sort of keeving or cold racking. So I know that Izzy and Mike at Barleywood, Lydia at Artistraw, that they've all referenced H2S being a little bit of a challenge. But in each case, those makers have said, well, the thing to do is to try and leave it if you can. They've all echoed separately this idea that the time's a great healer. And obviously this one's 3 years old now. And it still, to me, tastes kind of incredibly fresh in its fruit. And as you say, that H2S is gone. I think of some of the Kiev ciders that I've tried, you think this is kind of drink it now because it's, you know, it's soft, it's voluptuous, whatever. And this is lovely now, but you really get the sense that it has that aging potential, you know, that you could leave it even longer and it would just keep kind of developing the complexity because it's got that tannin structure to last for a good few more years.
And I wonder if that's why it has that really structured, not why, but one of the reasons it has that really structured kind of flavor and it feels so well integrated is because it has been in bottle now for 3 years. You know, it's had time to sort of mature and kind of age. And I wonder, like, certainly with other drinks, I find that's the case, that sort of over time they sort of integrate, you know, a little bit better and in the bottle. I wonder if that's one of the reasons it has that kind of that feeling.
Well, and yeah, and I think, I mean, we've hinted at it throughout, I think, already, but you know, the skill of the cider maker in this blend, matching that kind of Keeve blend with all those bittersweets, and then that Orchard blend that's got, you know, a healthy amount of sharps in there is quite a skill to behold, actually, I think.
Yeah, we're looking across, because obviously William gave us some of the information about what went into the cider, but looking across the three blends that went into it, it's about 20% bitter sharp in all of them, isn't it? But it tastes really, like you say, it's got that integration, and it doesn't come across as being very sharp or being like particularly like acidic, and it's just the right amount, isn't it, to balance that. Like we talked about in the Manchester Cider Club with Ross Cider the other week, and Tom Oliver said about balancing like tannin, acidity, and like the apple fruit and its expression. You can obviously do that in a number of different ways, and this is just a really lovely expression of like the fruit from those orchards, and this is obviously how he felt was the best way to present that.
Yeah, I feel this would be a really, really good cider to have with food as well. I know we're not at the moment, but this, you know, it just kind of feels like it wants to really sort of sink its teeth into some roast pork or something like that, something really high protein.
Yeah, and something salty. Like this wants a bit of salt and a bit of fat, doesn't it?
Mm.
I wonder if now's a good time actually to talk about something that I think this cider raises. Not as like necessarily an issue, but like James has done a great job as the cider critic, and everyone here has spoken about transparency in cider and how can we get more information onto the label. And we've all been privy to some information from William about the varieties that went into the cider, the sheer number of them. And it got me thinking, I don't know if you guys had a similar thought, but you know, you almost couldn't present the information about how this cider was made in a consumer-friendly way on this bottle. Like, it would be very difficult to explain exactly how all those different blends and all those different varieties have contributed to the cider in a simple way. And I wonder what people thought of that.
I've been thinking about it a bit, actually. And I wonder, if you look at something like Eve's Albie Hill, where they've listed the varieties and said what they're bringing to the mix, I think that kind of style would go very well with this. It doesn't necessarily have to be quite as detailed.
Yeah.
But something to help the consumer understand why it tastes the way it does, and why if they buy something else that says Keith on it, might be totally different. Just to give them that understanding that these different types of apple add a different element.
Mm.
That's missing.
Yeah, because, I mean, so the back of the label says, a naturally sparkling cider, keeved and bottle conditioned, made in the Normandy style, grown, pressed and bottled by hand at Smith Hayne Orchard, Devon, 2018 vintage single, no, SR, what does that mean? I don't know.
Special reserve.
4.5%. Special reserve, that's it, sorry. I see S and immediately think single variety. My brain just went there. And then it has a range, doesn't it, of dry to sweet, and it's at number 4, you know, in terms of, it's on the sweeter end of the spectrum.
Yeah, it doesn't really give you any indication of kind of what types of apple are in there, what you should expect from the flavour, other than it's going to be on the sweet end, which actually does it a disservice because, as we've been describing, there's so much more to it than just the sweetness.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially even in the world of Keeves, it's a supremely balanced cider, isn't it? And like I say, I sympathise with Smith Hayne that conveying a lot of that information would be difficult, particularly with the way this label is set out. But I agree with you, James, that what Eve Cidery do with their ciders in terms of explaining not necessarily the information that we were given, but how the varieties have impacted certain aspects of the flavour profile. I think that would be perfect. I agree with you.
I think Eve's obviously are an incredible example of people who just pack all that detail into a tiny, tiny space. And what I think they also do is, if you go to their website, Eve's will kind of build that information out a bit.
Yes.
Because a lot of people might get a cider and see all of that information and just not know what to do with it. You know, if you know your varieties, then great. If not, you've got all this information, but you know, you don't necessarily have the context. But I think that's somewhere that that every cidery has potentially an opportunity to show its working more with is just making sure that a consumer who maybe sees their cider on a shelf and Googles it or wants to learn more about their cider, you know, you can put this information online somewhere if you're interested in showing all this detail, and that I guess, is a lot easier than having a really, really data heavy back label.
Yeah.
As somebody who in his day to day writes quite a lot of back labels, you know, I understand the difficulty of kind of cramming everything that you want to say in there, especially when it's as technical as this. So I think the back label is, or if you, depending on how you do it, the front label or the side label is great for kind of giving the you know, the most important point. And I agree that when Tremlett and Yarlington and Davenant are playing such a key role here, it would be good to see those listed. But you don't need to have the full spiel, I suppose, on the label. You just need the most salient cues, and then perhaps the detail of the website where you can go and find out more if you want.
Well, I think in the interest of Smith Hain, I will point out that if you do visit their website, they have all of their currently available ciders listed, which is smithhainorchards.com, and it lists all the varieties that are involved in each bottle. The thing that may frustrate you if you look at it too closely is that the varieties listed are exactly the same for all of them. The Method Traditionnel, the Special Vintage Reserve, and they're just plain vintage. And I think that although they do have another page on the website which goes through the methodology, how they make it. It explains how keeving works. But I wonder if there's something more to be said of pointing out that they've made three quite unique and quite different ciders, but they've all come from the same base juice. Because it's quite easy, I think, to just see cider as coming from apples and that's the end of it. And it's quite an achievement to have three distinct ciders that are all made from the same juice, and because you've blended them differently and you've taken them in different directions with keeving, with in-bottle fermentation, or just with bottle conditioning. Like, you often see cider makers who don't release anything apart from a dry, medium, and a sweet. And that's always, from my point of view, you know, with the inbuilt bias that we have at Ross & Wye, where our philosophy is to make as many different ciders as possible and damned if they're good or if they're bad. But it feels like a waste if you're a cider maker, you have all these different apples and you just release a dry, medium, and a sweet. So if you're doing something different like this, which is where, you know, Will and Anna, they've tasted their cider, they've tried other people's, and they've come up with this vision where they like certain things, and they take their base juice in different directions to achieve all of those things, it shows a much deeper understanding of the process and a deeper desire to create something interesting than just saying one's dry, one's medium, one's sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, even though there are slightly different proportions, I believe the Method Traditionnel, he was saying there are a few more sharps and there's a lot of porter perfection. It really does kind of strike me when I speak to William or Anna and I taste these ciders, you know, that level of thought that's gone into to, you know, what do these apples want to be, how can I best kind of you know, showcase these flavors. And I think going back to what you said earlier, and what Ben and James were saying as well, I think tasting this again, those individual apples and those kind of, I suppose, individual decisions are just really, really shining through. And I know if we were to taste the green or the yellow, they'd be very, very different again. I mean, James, you've tasted the green label quite recently, haven't you? Your fine cider pears,
yes,
series for December. I mean, would you kind of be able to compare this to that? You know, from what you remember from a couple of months ago, or?
Well, I've been asleep since then, but yeah, I've had all three of them actually, and yeah, I did the green label against the barley wood, didn't I? As a bit of fun over Christmas, and I remember thinking how good it was, but also in comparison to the barley wood, how much kind of more tannin and structure there was. The barley wood was very unusual. But can I remember the difference between this one? I'm sorry, I can't. But they were
no,
it's all right. They were different, and you know that's the point of this, isn't it? And there's a barrel element in here as well, isn't there? The Tremlett's went in barrel for a bit. There's all these different things that have gone on, And it would be really useful just to understand the decisions and why, and you know, how that's created that end product and why they've chosen those three. I mean, you know, it's the art, it's the skill, and that's the bit that's that sets them out from everybody else, isn't it? You know, every maker has their own fingerprint, a stamp on it, and that's the thing to celebrate and make the most of. And like you said, the label's missing some detail, and the website could have a lot more. But it's hard. I know it's hard for cider makers, especially smaller ones. You know, William has a full-time job, doesn't he? This is a hobby for him. So, you know, that the priority is to get the stuff out there, I suppose, isn't it? And as time goes on, focus on the other elements. So hopefully, as time goes by, kind of the transparency will increase, the more information will be available, and consumers will be the better for it, you know.
Absolutely. There are kind of two things that have jumped out from that. I think one point which just occurred to me, obviously, both the green label and what we're drinking now, the red label Special Reserve, are both described in the kind of online shops that I've seen them in as being Kieved. But in fact, neither of them is entirely Kieved. That's only part of the story. And I know that William said that Kieved is a particular, you know, he really likes the flavors that brings. But he said he doesn't think that something that's entirely Kieved can quite get the balance that he's personally looking for. So this one we've discussed is 5/6 Kieved. I believe the green label is slightly less than that. So it's not, you know, if somebody's thinking, in either direction, I suppose, if somebody's thinking I love Kieved or Kieved's not for me, you know, that they don't necessarily have the full story from this. But the other thing I wanted to ask you, actually, Albert, one thing that William was saying is that as a way of sort of protecting against any potential faults or infection, uses a sort of small dose of sulfites at the at the start of the process before the juice has started fermentation. And I wondered whether sulfites were something that you could kind of talk to us a little bit about, because I often feel that they're discussed but without very much context, and sometimes people don't really understand what their role is and what they can do for a cider. So I wondered whether you could kind of talk us through that.
Well, sulfites in cider are really used in one of two ways. You either add them at pressing or you add them during storage or in packaging. And if you're adding them later in the process, then you're doing it because it's a stabilizer and an antioxidant. So that's where sulfur tends to get a negative image, because if you're a macro cider maker making a 50,000 liter batch of something, of course you can't possibly afford that to go wrong. So then they tend to be overcautious and they may add a large amount of sulfite, which will then translate into a soapy chemically flavor that is detectable if you're sensitive to it. And a small number of people aren't just sensitive to its presence, but they are allergic to it. But it is a very small number of people. But that overuse of sulfur by macro cider makers, and also the same problem I think in the wine industry, has given it a negative image and demonized it in its more important role from our point of view as a cider maker when you add it at pressing, where sulfur will do two things. It will partially kill the wild yeast. So if you're someone that wants to ferment a cider with a cultured yeast, maybe because you're in a, you know, you're in a different part of the world and you're using dessert fruits and you really want to exacerbate or focus on their aromatic qualities, you may choose to add a cultured yeast that brings out aromas as opposed to just relying on the wild yeast. Or you may like the sulfite because it's the single best way to guard against bacterial infection. And if you're using machine-picked fruit, like they are for some of their cider at Smith Hain, and like we do at Ross & Wye, then even though you're washing the fruit, you're hand-sorting the fruit, you still know that there's a bacterial load coming in on that fruit. And that bacterial load is going to get destroyed by fermentation. That's one of the great things about cider, is that fermentation is a great preservative itself. But you don't want something to go wrong in the early stages. So adding a small amount of sulfite at that time anything up to 100 parts per million, and a lot of people will add less, so the most we'll ever add is 50, then you're guaranteeing yourself basically the best shot at having a clean cider at the end of the day. And the impact on the quality of the fruit, the individual characteristics, as we can taste by drinking this bottle, is almost non-existent. I think if you're using a sensible amount of sulfate, and importantly, if you're aging it, then you're not going to have a problem because the fruit character is still going to come out. It's still possible to wild ferment, even if you dose with sulfite, because you have to add loads to kill all wild yeast, loads and loads, and no craft cider maker is adding that amount. So you can still have a wild ferment, and you're never going to have any funky flavors. You know, I've been going on, but I will just sum up by saying that sulfite can kill apiculate yeasts when you're adding it in that little moment. And apiculate yeasts can even release acetic acid as a natural byproduct of their fermentation. So sulfites just guarantee you no bacterial infections, and they reduce the risk that you might get from indigenous yeasts that are going to create funky flavors as well.
Thank you. I think another thing that I always think about when we're talking about sulfites is that the word itself, I mean, I'm not at all scientific minded, but you hear the word sulfite and you're thinking, you know, something chemical, which obviously it is, but you're also somehow it feels like something that's very sort of modern and an additive. And I think what kind of really strikes me sometimes is remembering that the use of you know, be it a sulfur candle or whatever it is, as a preservative, as a sterilizer, goes back to, well, to ancient Roman times in wine terms. They were you know, they were kind of killing infection with them. But even in cider, John Beale, writing in the 17th century, is advocating its use. And I was recently reading an article written by a Devon cider maker from 1898, who was writing a piece to talk about how he made a cider that had won at Bath and Wells the year before. And he said that, you know, any cider maker worth their salt knows to use a little bit of this at the time, you know, to make sure that their barrels are clean. And the same thing still happens in the whiskey industry. You know, with most of the sherry casks will have had a sulfur candle in. And I think, as you say, it's just something that's demonized quite often by people who have either associated it with what macro cider and wine do, or who just simply don't know what sulfites are and maybe see it on an ingredients list and assume that it's something inherently negative.
Well, the other thing to mention is that sulfites are a natural byproduct of fermentation. So even if you don't add them in this tiny, minute quantity at pressing, you still have to write on your label that it may contain sulfites, unless you have it lab tested and prove that it's less than 10 parts per million of the cider. It's a legal requirement because, as I said earlier, it's an allergen. So sulfite is something that must be respected and used appropriately, but is part of fermentation, even if you don't decide to add it.
To circle back to what James said about transparency in cider, and I think it's really important because, like you were saying, James, like absolutely spot on, that there's a good amount of information out there with cider makers, but there could be a lot more. But I do feel in many ways that that will grow at the more cider makers think that there is an appetite for it. You know, the more conversation like this happen and the more consumers who are emailing their cider makers being like, how did you make this? And being very curious. I think that's the way that we can show cider makers that, like, this is something that a lot of people care about. And I think, yeah, that's the thing, is that you've got guys like Smith Hain or Eves who are doing a good job at the moment, but there's a lot of cider makers who are leaving quite a lot to be desired, aren't they? But that's because they probably don't think that anybody particularly cares, and the truth is it's a very small number of people in the very small cider bubble that is kind of craft, fine cider, whatever we call it, that do actually care. And then you've got, you know, the wider drinks industry as a whole. But the more that we say to them, no, we want more information, please tell us exactly how this was made, then the more I think we'll see that happening.
I think that's a really good point, because I think there are two reasons for transparency, aren't there? I mean, we're all either in Albert and James's case, makers, or in our case, Ben, people who are really, really passionate about cider. And so we want to know this information just because we're interested. And we're you know, absolutely fascinated to know the processes and the apples and everything else. But the other reason for transparency, and obviously this isn't something at all to do with Smith Hain, but the other reason for transparency is simply to know what has or hasn't been added to your cider. And James, you've written about this and spoken about this a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think actually we're at quite a pivotal moment at the moment, because, you know, I think there's been a lot of chatter over the last few years, especially among the smaller makers, around, you know, how do people understand the difference between their products and what you would find on kind of the mainstream lines in pubs and in the supermarkets. You know, when you've got two things sat next to each other and they both say they're cider, how do you get yours to stand out? And well, the answer is you tell them, you're transparent, you start the conversation, you open it from your side, you say what you do and don't do with your cider. And, you know, in the last year, we've seen some of the big makers actually put ingredients on their labels. Now, I won't say that they haven't got work to do still as well, but they've come out and they've put the stall out and they've said what's in theirs. And craft cider is well behind it now. So, you know, I my argument has changed recently, and it's more of a call to arms now to get smaller producers, macro producers, to step up to the plate as well and show the difference. That's what needs to happen now.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, should we say, for the benefit of listeners, where they can currently get this cider that we've been waxing so lyrical about?
The best thing to do is to head straight to smithhainorchards.com. They have a full list of all of their distributors where you can buy it, as well as directly from the makers themselves.
They do a very interesting subscription box type deal, don't they?
They do, yes.
I think that's really cool.
You can order six bottles per month for some minimum order, just on free six for annual subscription.
I think that's brilliant for a cidery that only sells three products. Like, that's fantastic, isn't it?
It's confidence.
It's confident. Yeah.
You know that you are going to want to buy this cider and drink this cider.
You are going to want at least one of these a month.
Per week.
To be fair, I think you know, that's well founded after what we've drunk tonight.
I agree, and actually, the value for money with Smith Hain is something else.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, how much did I pay for this bottle? About
£9.50 on Squirtings, I think.
£9.50. I mean, that when you consider the price of some cider being sold,
£9.50
is absolutely fantastic for a keep cider that's been so meticulously created, and for their, you know, Discord Method Traditional as well in the same price range.
Well, I was going to say about the Method Traditional, which we didn't really touch on too much in this chat, but it is phenomenal. One of the best ciders I had last year, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Like, you know, up there with ciders that are, you know, that are put there as, you know, sort of champagne style or celebration style, £20 a bottle type ciders. I would take the Smith Hain over pretty much every single one, except maybe Tinston's Anatomy, but that's because I really like Tinston's Anatomy and everybody knows that. But that Smith Hain Method Trad is absolutely phenomenal. Like, unbelievable.
It's wonderful, isn't it? And it's quite different to a lot of the other traditional method ciders out there, because although, as we've discussed, it has that proportion of sharps, it still has some bittersweets and some bitter sharps in it. So it's kind of got a little bit more structure than some, you know, and depth than some traditional methods that you taste. And at £10, I think it's got to be one of the, you know, one of the best, alongside Tinston, one of the best value traditional method ciders that are currently available. And I think generally, when you taste any Smith Hain, but particularly if you taste a couple next to each other, and you see, you know, they're all of this this really, really kind of high quality.
Yeah,
it really struck me last year that they've got to be kind of one of the real inside tips in cider at the moment. It's great that you know, that obviously everyone here has had a chance to try it and is enthused. But I think they're definitely a cidery that I'd like to see more discussed. And so it's been really wonderful to see their product become available on The Cat in the Glass and on Scratting as well.
Absolutely. I'm going to be a real nuisance now. I'm going to circle all the way back to the flavour because I'm now about two-thirds of the way down my bottle. I wanted to feel how it would develop because I had a French cider 3 days before we recorded this, which I would describe as being a similar level of sweetness. I think in terms of the literal amount of sugar in both bottles was comparable. But with that French cider, by the time I got this far down the bottle, I was really beginning to feel the sugar. Whereas I think what's interesting about the blend that we've got here is that despite coming from an oak barrel where you may be expecting micro oxygenation to impact the sort of intensity of the tannins in this cider, it's got heaps of tannin, like really, really big, grippy tannins that I would guess from the varieties he's listed, they're coming especially from the Tremulous Bitter, the Chisel Jersey, the Harry Masters Jersey. You know, those three are heavy hitters of the tannin world, where they bring astringency and leatheriness, and they can take a long time to soften. But it works really well, the amount of them they've got here, with the level of sugar that's left in this blend, in a way that I think actually is probably one of the strongest assets of this cider. But that's something that surprised me, because on my first sip, I thought, well, I'm really enjoying this, but I do wonder if maybe these tannins are still surprisingly big, considering, as Adam said earlier, this is now nearly, well, 2.5 years since harvest for this cider. But actually, the overall balance really requires them to be there and to be so bold and to say to the sugar, look, you're present in the cider, but you're not the master of it.
I think it's a really wonderful, as James said, a really wonderful example of considered blending. Because as you say, Albert, it's got those wonderful tannins that probably from the Tremulous, the Chisel, the Harry Masters, but it's got that sort of rich, ripe kind of Dabernet and Yarlington kind of full juicy body as well. So you kind of have the best of both worlds, I think. And that's what really stood out to me when I first tasted it. And I think that's what in my head kind of elevated it ahead of some other Kievs that I've had from time to time. It's just finding that equilibrium.
It's stunning.
It is. It's fantastic.